So I'm happy to introduce our next speaker, Kalpana Seshadri, who is a professor of English at Boston College. And among her books is Desiring Whiteness, a Lacanian Analysis of Race, which I think could has to be counted among the major books published in recent decades of critical race studies, which is also why we are so happy to have her here today sharing her thoughts on political mimesis, colonial mimicry in the context of race as a particular European system, structural system of dealing with human diversity. Please welcome Kalpana Seshadri.
Thank you, Anselm, and the rest of your team, Nadia, Dunya, Diana, for your hospitality, for thinking of me, for having me here. I feel very privileged and honored to be presenting at this museum. So my presentation is going to be a little conceptual. So what I did was I made some slides as a way for everyone to sort of follow the thread of my argument, if you want to call it that. So, and I'd be happy to clarify anything because I'm going fairly quickly through the argument. So I'll be happy to clarify maybe during Q&A. So I titled this paper, The Dis-ease of Political Mimesis, because what sort of occurred to me as sort of the main issue was about how we think about not just representation, but also viewing, looking at something. So what, and the complexity of the look in terms of the gaze, of the eye, all these different concepts that are associated with it. Okay, so, and race, of course, is in many ways a visual regime, a particular way of looking at people and situating them in a hierarchy. It's a way of managing human difference, if you could say. So this unique exhibit, based on Julius Lipps's work, The Savage Hits Back, as well as the upcoming screening of Jean Rouch's Les Mirefous, provide a distinct opportunity to contemplate the nuances of colonial mimicry and the gaze. However, when I sat at my desk last week to collect my thoughts, I found that I could not separate my thinking about the colonial gaze from the disorienting effects of the political spectacle that has overtaken contemporary reality in the West. I am referring not only to the stupefying tableau of the Trump impeachment inquiry that's played out on television, it's continuing to play out on television, everybody's glued to it, but more broadly to the farcical displays of white nationalism and cultural paranoia that appears to grip almost all Western democracies today. As a referendum on values and ideology, the impeachment inquiry appeared as the ultimate battle for the survival of those quiet norms signaled by Mr. George Kent, who was hailed as the star witness for Democrats, his bow tie and his wire rim glasses. As one New York Times columnist suggested, what is really on trial is seriousness itself and the dignity and gravity of legal proceedings. For those horrified by the Trumpian spectacle, the belief is that if the interloper or the joker were to be expelled from the White House, then fine, everything's going to be great. The authority of government and the decent social norms attached to it will automatically reassert their legitimacy and everything will go back to normal again. But really, is it that simple? If these transgressors, or ideological aliens, as they're called, are truly heterogeneous to the political system, right? Where is that outside, that particular outside that they're coming from? Is it possible that there is, in fact, a greater intimacy between the norm and its transgression that we should acknowledge? Hence, I followed my critical intuition that there is a salient, that there is a salient the salient connection to be made between responses to colonial representations of whiteness and contemporary assertions of it, and that they could be traced by examining these moments and images of heightened visual dissonance. Undoubtedly, the concept of the gaze applies not only to the colonial theater, but also to contemporary societies of the spectacle. We can identify and name our present political moment as one that I think is marked by a dis-ease, right? We're not at ease, it's a disease, it's a dis-ease. The dis-ease of political mimesis. My sense is that the concepts such as colonial mimicry and the reversed gaze should be approached as providing a genealogy of the present. In fact, so when we look at those, when we look at that wonderful exhibit that's been put together, and really it's marvelous, I think we should permit those images to say something to us about our present condition. For me, there's no other interest in them, really. And rather than just look at them as historical objects, but see them as something, as giving us a story about ourselves now in the present, right? So that's what I mean about the idea of, like, they provide a genealogy of the present. In fact, we can discern the full relevance of these concepts only in terms of what they reveal about our present reality. Thus, I suggest that the interest of the artifacts and images on exhibit here lies not in their intended meanings, such as, you know, you look at the figure, the frontispiece figure of the African. The African image of the white man who's sort of screaming. The issue is not to ask, what does it mean? What does this mean, right? So I suggest the interest of these artifacts on exhibit lies not in their intended meanings, their signified content, but in what they reveal about the function of mimesis in the evolution of political ideology. Okay. So in other words, we must ask not what do these artifacts mean, what did the native artisan or performer intend? These questions are problematic as they presume a context-free art critic, right? Or we come up with an anthropological explanation such as these images were used for this particular purpose or these images were not used in that particular fashion. For me, that's not where the interest lies in these images. But I'm more interested in asking, why these artifacts now, here, and for this particular audience, is there something exceptional about our present times when concepts like the reversed gaze, modes of mimicry, mockery, even faithful mimesis of whiteness expressed through art and performance by subaltern classes suddenly seem compelling and provocative? Right? Why are we suddenly interested in this? Right? How are they made to figure in counter-narratives about the place of visuality in Western politics, and engage our analysis of mimesis and power? So let me state at the outset that I don't believe we can discover any simple correspondence or analogy between, for example, the spectacle of Hauke spirit possession, filmed as a performance by Rusch, and the contemporary populist spectacle, right, of white nationalism. There isn't a sort of a simple analogy there, a connection that's kind of straightforward that you can make. At least I don't think so. The connections are discernible only when they are contextualized within the wider context, that is, the discourse of political mimesis that is so central to liberal democracy, right? So this is the way I sort of visualize it. In other words, the question of colonial mimicry and the gaze have to be situated within the larger context of Western political ideology. Its stated norms and values on the one hand, and its unstated fantasies and transgressions on the other. Before I take up the question of political mimesis more broadly, I think the term colonial mimicry warrants some clarification. As a concept, it is not simply identical to the imitation or mockery of the white man by the colonized, right? For instance, Lipps writes that once the colonized discovered that the white man was merely, quote-unquote, another species of the human race, they, quote, treated him to mockery, exactly as it did any member of their own tribe, especially when they recognized his weakness, unquote. While caricature and satire may be universal genres, right, they don't illuminate the big picture in which colonial ideology is situated. Nor does it tell us anything about how subjects are constituted by colonial power relations. Okay? So the point is that mimicry and mockery are not simply on the side of the colonized as weapons of the weak. They are, in fact, constitutive of colonial discourse. So Homi Bhabha, a post-colonial critic, in his classic essay Of Mimicry and Man, that Keith Lim, I think, is sort of like riffing on, right? So offers a thorough analysis of this counterintuitive perception. Right? He argues that the entire edifice of the colonial civilizing mission, its agenda of reform and regulation, is already a mockery of itself. So he writes, and here's the quote on the slide, "The effect of mimicry on the authority of colonial discourse is profound and disturbing. For in normalizing the colonial state or subject, the dream of post-Enlightenment civility alienates its own language of liberty and produces another knowledge of its norms. It is from this area between mimicry and mockery where the reforming civilizing mission is threatened by the displacing gaze of its disciplinary double that my instances of colonial imitation come. What they all share is a discursive process by which the excess or slippage produced by the ambivalence of mimicry," so he italicizes the ambivalence, as you can see, "almost the same, but not quite, does not merely rupture discourse, but becomes transformed into an uncertainty which fixes the colonial subject as a partial presence. By partial, I mean both incomplete and virtual." Right, and you can well see how this speaks to our present rhetoric as well with the Gulf War or the war in Afghanistan, et cetera. It's about bringing good governance, good government, or bringing democracy to the others. So this is what Bhabha is fundamentally talking about when he's talking about colonial mimicry, that in speaking the discourse of Western liberal democracy, good governance, et cetera, the colonizer experiences another voice speaking, mocking him, right? Because he's alienating himself from his own Enlightenment ideals. It's exposing the split within the ideology. So Bhabha's essay is interested primarily in the doublespeak, the ambivalence of colonial discourse that produces certain uncanny effects. So in the following, I pursue a related but slightly different issue, namely how political power works ideologically in relation to transgression. To put it in more psychoanalytic terms, we can say that the ambivalence of colonial mimicry also authorizes transgressions. This transgression, which is part and parcel of colonial mimicry, does not come from the outside, right? It's not the native speaking back to the colonizer so much. To assault Western political ideology, but it emerges from its own fault lines. With reference to transgression and subjectivity, the concepts of colonial mimicry and the gaze pertain more to the structure of Western political institutions than they do to the existential relations between colonizer and colonized. Right, so let me repeat that again. So with reference to transgression subjectivity, the concepts of colonial mimicry and gaze, right, pertain more to the structure. So it's a structural issue having to do with ideology, right, of Western political institutions than they do with existential relations between colonizer and colonized. What becomes nakedly apparent in the colonial field is the fact that the authority of the law depends upon its own transgression. Another reason why it is limiting to define colonial mimicry as something that just follows when the native discovers that the white man is human, just like themselves, et cetera, pertains to the presupposition that it is based upon. This view assumes that racial looking, which is very specific to Western culture, is a universal practice, right? We assume that the other is looking at a white man, but then it's not. We don't actually know if that's what they are seeing is whiteness and the white man in the way in what it means in the West. Okay, I shall come back to this later, but here I shall simply assert that we cannot assume that race is a system of understanding human difference is a shared epistemology across cultures and between rulers and subaltern classes. The evidence, on the contrary, points to a structural lack of synchrony in their responses to each other. The heightened anxieties palpable in the colony derive from this non-synchrony, this dissonance that is played out both orally and visually. There is a split between the eye and the gaze, and an anxiety that unsettles the seer. Any analysis of colonial mimesis, then, must be situated in that gap. Okay. So let us briefly note some key points with regard to the history of mimesis and politics in the West. I cannot here take up the rich accounts discussing the complex relation between politics and performance in Western culture. Okay, and there's a long tradition of political theory associated with this. So. But just a few key points. According to Jacques Rancière, the history of critical thought with regard to politics and theatrical mimesis is encapsulated by the paradox of the spectator. In the tradition following Plato, the theater is a space of separation and illusion, and spectatorship is a state of captivation and passive inaction. In other parallel traditions, quote, he says, theater emerged as a form of aesthetic constitution, sensible constitution of the community, as a way of occupying a place and a time, as a body in action, as opposed to mere apparatus of laws, a set of perceptions, gestures, and attitudes that precede and preform laws and political institutions. That's the end of that quote. In a somewhat contrary vein, Guy Debord, writing in 1967 about the existential crisis of living under late capitalism and its bizarre rule by the commodity image, suggested that henceforth society could be analyzed only through the grammar of the spectacle. Right? Here, mimesis is a form of depoliticization. So, in the society of the spectacle, all social relations are mediated by images, and the spectacle alone is real. In other words, all social activity is devoted to the development and maintenance of the spectacle, which is also the contemporary form of capital. For Debord, the spectacle is fundamentally a modality of social control. Right. So this is perhaps in greater evidence today, with the rule of big data and the digitalized spectacle. Reality today has so many data points that mobilize and determine social life. Right? We just have to think about Facebook and social media and that sort of thing. However, in Being Singular Plural, Jean-Luc Nancy insists that there is no society without the spectacle because society is a spectacle of itself. For Nancy and Rancière, theater is, in a sense, the condition of possibility for politics, right? Conceived as a co-appearing in community. In this view, theater, or more broadly, mimesis, serves as a touchstone of democracy, where the singular coming forward of each depends on the plurality of being with others, right? So the most idealized space of such a coming forward the way is the way we are with each other at the voting place, or perhaps even right here. We come forward, we perform in a certain kind of a way as audience members and speaker. That's the kind of political mimesis that Rancière and Nancy want to celebrate as indicative of democratic social values. But for Debord, on the other hand, as Rancière says, and Rancière is sort of like analyzing Debord, right? What is in fact the essence of a spectacle for Debord? For Debord, the spectacle is exteriority, The spectacle is a rain of vision. Right? One of the reasons why I felt like I needed the slides, because everybody today needs slides to sort of pay attention to a boring academic talk. So I hope I'm keeping your attention with these slides. Okay, so what in fact is the essence of the spectacle for Debord? It's exteriority. The spectacle is a reign of vision, and vision is exteriority, that is self-dispossession. What human beings contemplate in the spectacle is the activity that they have been robbed of. It is their own essence become alien, turned against them, organizing a collective world whose reality is that dispossession. Debord's critique of the spectacle, then, could be understood as a simple failure of democracy. So you could just read it that way, right? But I think what attention to colonial mimicry makes clear is that this failure is not something new, in the sense that it was great before and now it got broken. But it is, in fact, integral or constitutive of the ideological fantasy of liberal democracy. Since the terms gaze and mimicry allude to Lacan's discussions, I find it useful to translate Debord's argument into psychoanalytic terms. Given the dominance of the imaginary field, perhaps I can just illustrate this with a little video. So could we have this, please? The video or the sense of like the ideological fantasy of liberal democracy. Okay, so this is something that appears in the Atlantic magazine, which is pretty well known in the US. And the article said, "Suddenly I'm in favor of the Trump campaign." I think you can read this at the bottom. Most of the Japanese, this video went viral. Some of you may have seen it, I'm not sure. But it went viral in the 2016 election. And basically, it's a Japanese woman who's acting through this. And the Japanese words fundamentally say, through the TV screen, "Trump is God," and the closing credits say, "This is Trump Banzai," or "May Trump live 10,000 years. It also appears, you would normally see Banzai to the emperor. If Trump made this official campaign video, says the James Fallows, the author of this little article, "I would consider voting for him. Thanks to my friends in the US, thanks to Mike Diva for this video." Okay, so if we could... thank you. This and you want to scream and laugh at the same time, right? And of course, as Fallows says, okay, so this becomes part of the Trump campaign, I'm ready to vote for him, right? It's okay, so I just want to sort of say a few things about this. So since the terms gaze and mimicry, and I think so I'm trying to connect the idea of colonial mimicry to this contemporary society, the spectacle. Since the terms gaze and mimicry allude to Lacan's discussions, I find it useful to translate Debord's argument into psychoanalytic terms. Given the dominance of the imaginary field over the spectacle, we can say that for Debord, the society of the spectacle exposes the phantasmatic underside of liberal democracy, its particular structure of power and ideology, the framework we need to see the connections between colonial mimicry and contemporary spectacle is provided, as I think, very well by psychoanalysis, but also deconstruction. Namely, that power or law in Western culture is always already internally split. The situation in the colony is especially stark. Rather than representing absolute rectitude, we can see that, in fact, the law maintains zones of ambiguity, where the line between what is permitted and what is prohibited is undefined, right? So we can think of this as a kind of like the line of ambiguity there. Anything can happen in these zones, from sexual transactions, transgressions of various kinds. We know this happened in the colonies all the time. Free speech, saying whatever you want that might controvert authority. Unsanctioned behaviors such as spirit possession, all of which the authorities are aware of but choose to ignore up to a certain point. So there's a moment when they choose not to ignore it anymore. So the law turns a blind eye, you could say. In Lacanian terms, we can say that power here is predicated on the pre-existence of the gaze. I see only from one point, but in my existence, I am looked at from all sides. These acts do not truly challenge the law. On the contrary, this is a way for the law to secretly include within itself the pleasures of transgression without explicit acknowledgement. As Lacan says, the gaze is that underside of consciousness or the law. In colonialism, this structure is less well hidden and becomes common knowledge. Without these zones of quote-unquote toleration, colonial authority would never be able to survive, not for a day. In other words, in colonialism, power requires and depends upon its own transgressions. The important point, however, is that colonial mimicry is not safely in the past or confined to discrete performances or artifacts or something quaint that we can examine with amused and detached historical interest. Rather, in the contemporary society of the spectacle, colonial mimicry is hyperbolized in the metropole as a real condition of political life. That's what I meant by the video that I showed you. The zones of ambiguity that in colonialism served as pressure valves define political reality today. When it is hidden, the underside of the law shelters relatively benign practices, such as driving slightly above the speed limit, forms of prostitution, passing as escort services, at least in the US, certain forms of drug use, tax loopholes, so on and so forth. But today, that ambiguity has overtaken legality itself. The spectacular relations of power are now played out in a variety of modalities. So we have this sort of overlay, right? Including the infantilization of facts, the trivialization of evidence, the outright denial of history, and the spectral rise of white nationalism at the heart of liberal democracy. In the society of the spectacle, the zone of legal ambiguity becomes coeval with political life. De Boer's rather prophetic words were, "In a world that really has been turned on its head, truth is a moment of falsehood." What interests me about this sentence is the way it encapsulates the contemporary crisis and the ancient relation between politics and mimesis. Today, in the society of the digital spectacle, falsehood is also the moment of truth. If that video were to become part of the Trump campaign, I too would be tempted to vote for Trump. Right? Okay. So, I want to elaborate now on the point that I made earlier regarding theoretical and political limitations of the common sense view of colonial mimicry. And this is just there for, it doesn't really say anything. It's a very well-known image from the cover of James Clifford's book, some of you may be aware of. It's an Igbo ritual with a mask of a white man. I want to elaborate now on the point I made earlier regarding the theoretical and political limitations of the common sense view of colonial mimicry. When we adopt this framework of the law in colonialism, that is, its investment in the gaze, right? So not the common sense view that they're laughing at us or they're mocking us, that sort of thing, but it's really structural. It has to do with the gaze, right? And it has to do with the transgressive aspect of the law. And its dependence upon ambiguity for its survival, we begin to see clearly that assumptions such as reversed gaze and colonial mimicry as acts of bold resistance fail to contend with the logic of power. In the absence of this framework, we risk reducing the spectacle of the colony into a simple surveillance state, right? That is, a condition where there is perfect coordination between the eye and the gaze, right? Such as 1984, right? The seer, and then there is the scene, Big Brother. That's already a kind of an ideological fantasy of like this perfect coordination of power, right? Anxiety and the gaze really have to do with the sort of the cracks and the fissures in power. That's the argument that I'm making, right? So for sure, the colony is a space where power relations are enforced through phantasmatic regimes of visibility. It's not that I'm denying that. So for instance, you have the chaotic native quarters and bazaars versus a disciplined white town, the crisply costumed colonial officer versus the native garb of the colonized, and of course the so-called white skin of the colonizer versus the black skin of the colonized. So it's a theater of power, very visual. Colonialism is inherently theatrical and spectacle-making. And this theatricality, as Ranger and Hobsbawm, who have been quoted in the exhibit, have shown, was reinforced by the performance of invented ceremonies and spectacular traditions that were designed to dazzle and intimidate the colonized into acquiescence. Beyond the ideology of stark differences, however, the colonial stage also harbored corners of unsanctioned but not illegal performances, right? Spaces of fantasy where anything could happen, where there's a splitting of the eye and the gaze, right? So James Scott's Resistance and the Arts of Domination offers one of the most comprehensive and thoroughly researched analyses of the theatrics of power in the colony. He suggests that the relations between the subordinate and dominant groups is marked by the adoption of official scripts. He writes, "On a daily basis, the impact of power is more readily observed in acts of deference, subordination, and ingratiation. The script and stage directions for subordinate groups are generally more confining than for the dominant. They are required to perform acts of deference, flattery, subservience, and self-denigration. Quote, a convincing performance may require both the suppression or control of feelings that would spoil the performance and the stimulation of emotions that are necessary to the performance. More of the public life of subordinates and of the dominant is devoted to, quote unquote, command performances, right? So you have to behave a certain way. You have to exhibit your subservience, right? But the dominant, too, must perform their power through appearances of haughtiness, hauteur, gestures of superiority, et cetera. And I think we see some of that in the exhibit, where you have the couple, who are standing so stiff they seem to be falling backwards, right? So for both groups, these official transcripts, as Scott terms them, entail changes in the posture, demeanor, and apparent activity when masters and servants encounter each other. So colonial literature is filled with these kinds of situations where the master is relaxed doing something when suddenly the servant walks in and he has to jump to attention, so to say, or hold himself very stiff and very haughty and those sorts of things. Some of you may be familiar with George Orwell's little piece, Shooting an Elephant, which sort of speaks to that. It's a really wonderful little story. For both groups, these official transcripts entail changes in posture and demeanor. Scott argues that the colonized exercise greater self-control by adopting a series of masks, including those of ignorance, stupidity, and simplicity, as smokescreens for what he terms as the hidden transcript. The hidden transcript refers not only to the natural impulses of rage and rebuttal, but also to the secret subcultures of resistance and revolt that contradict and repudiate the official transcript. These hidden transcripts, then, are performed in secret in the absence of the colonizer in remote communities or secret societies. So the haka spirit possession ritual is pretty much part of this kind of paradigm. Scott's classification of colonial performances in terms of official and hidden transcripts has the virtue of illustrating the ideology as a separation of the legal from the illegal in colonial performance. However, his assumption that the hidden transcripts constitute, quote, disguised resistance of infrapolitics, unquote, fails to contend with the complexity of the colonial gaze. The law sees and does not see at the same time. It's sort of like the moth in A Passage to India, if anybody is familiar with this novel. It's also, it's the outside is also always inside. As Lacan says, from the moment that this gaze appears, the subject tries to adapt himself to it. He becomes that punctiform object, that point of vanishing between being with, being with which the subject confuses his own failure. Furthermore, of all the objects in which the subject may recognize his dependence in the register of desire, the gaze is specified as unapprehensible, unquote. I quote from Lacan's seminar 11 in order to underline the fact that the Lacanian concepts of the gaze and mimicry are unavoidably solipsistic. That's the import of them. As subjects constituted within a historical discourse, the notion that there might be an ideological subject position outside the structure of colonial power, colonial mimesis, or more broadly, Western institutions of political mimesis, is the phantasmatic underside of the structure itself. So Michael Taussig's struggle to take measure of his epistemological prison house is instructive. Okay, and I'm going to close with this. In Mimesis and Alterity, he writes about the unsettling images of the white man produced by the colonized other. He then expresses his desire to stop yet another defensive appropriation of the unfamiliar by means of an explanation, right? It's really noble. Thus, before turning to a discussion of Hauke's spirit possession, he offers a personal and intimate response to an Igmo image of a white man rising from the earth, photographed by Herbert Cole in Nigeria. It is worth quoting in full. He frightens me, this African white man. He unsettles. He makes me wonder without end. Was the world historical power of whiteness achieved then through its being sacred as well as a profane power? It makes me wonder about the constitution of whiteness as global colonial work and also as a minutely psychic one involving powers invisible to my senses, but all too obvious as reflected to me now by this strange artifact. I know next to nothing of the context of ritual, belief, or a social practice in which an older anthropology, eager for the native's point of view, would enmesh this African white man, explain him away, Africanize them as opposed to whitenize them. All I have is the image and its brief caption, and I am my own gaping subject of analysis. For it is precisely this fractured plane of visibility and invisibility that constitutes the impact of the image on an uncomprehending West, now face to face with itself, bursting the earth. For the white man to read this face means facing himself as others read him, and the native's point of view can never substitute for the fact that now the native is the white man himself, and that suddenly, woefully, it dawns that the native's point of view is endless and myriad. The white man, as viewer, is here virtually forced to interrogate himself, to interrogate the other in and partially constitutive of his many and conflicting selves. And as yet, we have few ground rules for how such an interrogation should or might proceed. Such is the effect of the reflection and afterimage of an afterimage receding into a limitless horizon where the contemplative stance of their aura-filled cult object becomes our objet d'art, but not before the ground has been cleared by the erasure of critical distance effected by shock. Such face-to-faceness no doubt brings its quotient of self-congratulations. They think we are gods. But being a god is okay, only so long as it isn't excessive. After all, who knows, in imaging us as gods, might they not take our power? So this passage has been commented upon by others such as Paul Stoller in his work Embodying Colonial Memories, Spirit Possession and Power in the Hauka in West Africa. Stoller correctly remarks that Tausig is captured by the figure because it, quote, makes him aware of his own whiteness, of the global project of whiteness. He adds that what remains unexpressed, though, is the other side of the physiognomic equation. What did whiteness mean to the communities of the Oweri Igbo that constructed Mbari houses, unquote? Stoller then goes on to offer an explanation of the ritual significance these figures had for the Igbo. Astonishingly, though, neither Tausig nor Stoller questioned the ontological basis of whiteness itself. So convinced are they of being, quote-unquote, white men, and the universality of whiteness as a sign, its meaning guaranteed by a perfect union of the signifier and the signified without excess, that they do not see their own part in reproducing a meaning system and performing it through repetition. This repetition is what I wish to underline as colonial mimicry. As subjects of whiteness, the self-identified white men are assailed by what Lacan terms as a scopic drive. The white man sees whiteness looking at them from the place of the other. As white men, the Igbo white image installs them as gods, subjects not in a symbolic order based on imaginary identification, as might be the case with any ordinary photograph, because surely Michael Tausig and Paul Stoller have seen pictures of white people before, if not of themselves, but never have they said, that's whiteness to that photograph, that's me. But they see themselves as subjects in the real without lack. Colonial mimicry, then, can be analyzed only in relation to this hyperbolic subject that emerges in the field where the law enjoys its own transgressions. And the subject is sustained by a fantasy of its own lack of lack, its plenitude, its fullness, and its completeness. In the society of the spectacle, this mimic subject is a leader of the free world. Thank you.
Would you prefer staying up there or join me down here?
As you wish. I'll be happy to come down here.
Okay, sure.
I am rather short, so if you want me to be up here, I'd be happy to be up here.
I can barely see. I have
to be on tiptoes to reach the table. Sorry.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
It was
clear.
It was dense. I think it was an amazing talk. But I think one could spend a lot of time unpacking and testing and debating it. At least I would not claim that I completely got everything. So I'll ask if. I'll have to look at the watch to see. Okay, we do have a bit of time. Could I just get a sense of how many of you might have an immediate question of understanding, of just a comment? All right. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What did you mean by this? What did you mean by that? Why did you have this slide? Anything like that would be fine.
Yeah, great. So allow me to just begin maybe with okay. I'm not very clear myself now in this, but it's just about this. So I think that you basically ended with a relatively clear description, at least from my blurry mind, of whiteness itself as mimicry.
That's right.
And I mean, that's a very important trope in critical whiteness studies that I just like you, if you could, how exactly you are connecting this to the political mimesis of liberal democracy, because that seemed to me to be the main arch of your argument. Mm-hmm. In the difference to, say, the ideological fantasy of 1984, and this Trumpian
spectacle.
So I just like you to revisit that main argument of how this, what you mean by whiteness as mimicry, and what its structural connection is with political mimesis in liberal democracy, or the liberal subject and its liberty, its freedom, its self-possession. It's
thank you for your interest in what I have to say, and I'm very grateful for your question. So I'm going to speak in a way where I'm not going to quote anybody or cite anybody. So I'm just, you know, it's a synthesis. What I'm presenting is a sort of synthesis of various thinkers and sort of working from that. So I hope you'll assume that I can footnote everything that I'm saying. All right? So I will not provide the footnotes. All right. Sorry, I'm an academic. I teach. So this is, I don't go anywhere without my baggage of footnotes. So the premise that I'm beginning with, that I didn't sort of, that perhaps I should have stated more clearly, is that the Western liberal political thought is always already split on the inside, right? So it's not a perfect sort of a system that aims to represent everybody and formally invest people with the kinds of rights that it ideally hopes to. Is that making sense? So in a way, what it has is that it has a certain kind of a split where the law is in some sense sort of haunted by its own inadequacy. That's one way to think about it in terms of inadequacy. Or the fact that the law has a way of sort of like including within itself transgressions as a way to sort of sustain itself, okay? Because in an authoritarian society, things just get prohibited. That's it, not that that works fully. But in a democratic society, what we have is the law functioning in a certain kind of way where you have to have zones of ambiguity, where it's okay, you can get away with it. The law turns a blind eye, right? But there's another aspect to this. It's not just a political issue. For me and for many other critical race theorists, we cannot understand the structure of Western political culture without recognizing and acknowledging that it is based, that liberalism itself, right, emerges from a certain kind of a form of thinking and an ideology that is about the system of race and of difference and hierarchization. So in my view, I don't distinguish between race and racism. I think the system of race is inherently hierarchical. It is inherently racist. So what do I mean by this? So liberal political democracy, I think, is founded on a certain notion of, so in Lacanian terms and psychoanalytic terms, is founded in a certain kind of a system where whiteness becomes a kind of like a signifier, like a phallic signifier, a meta signifier, right? And it organizes human beings in relation to it. In many ways, you can say that whiteness is a signifier. It's a very odd thing for someone such as myself. I grew up in India, which is a heavily caste society, let me be clear with this, where appearance is not determinant of your of who you are. Discrimination doesn't happen merely by appearance. It happens by your ethnicity, by your caste, by your name, by your language, that sort of thing. It's a caste system. Yes, of course, there is a sort of a preference for a certain kind of a look, but it's merely a preference. You're not going to be discriminated against for a job, so on and so forth, because you are paler or darker. That's not going to happen. Do you follow? So it's not a race system. So for me, coming to the US, I was just shocked to sort of realize that it's a really visual regime, and that it's a very highly calibrated visual regime where people know how to read bodies. That's the point, right? And whiteness itself, the idea of whiteness, there is no word in any Indian language, okay, and I can only speak for India here, where a human being can be white. White is white. This is white. This is what white means, right? The idea that human beings can be white is completely without sort of any, you know, we have terms for white people, but, you know, they're not, we don't call them white, they're just pale-skinned or lighter or them or something like that, right? Gora, that's a term that you may be aware of. So the issue is that, you know, when you think about whiteness itself as something that that organizes human difference in order to kind of like make whiteness a kind of an ideal that everybody aspires to, including people who are white. That's the point. And that there's a relation between liberal democracy and the regime of race that is made evident in the history of colonialism. It is made evident in the history of slavery. It is made evident in the very organization of liberal democracies. Think of the American Constitution, whatever. You know, you guarantee rights to everybody, but in fact, it excludes these other people. So there's no separating race from that. So fundamentally, for me, you know, so when you think about, so it's that haunting, right, that kind of like threatens the law, threatens the ideals of liberal democracy, where you have a kind of a dialectical situation, you could say, between the regime of whiteness that organizes subjectivity, and you have the discourse of liberal democracy that guarantees rights to everybody. So you have a law that is in some ways highly ambivalent and also tolerates zones of ambiguity, all right? So it's a very complicated argument, but believe me, you can footnote all of this. Am I clear? Do you follow what I'm saying? Yeah, this wouldn't work in a completely authoritarian situation, right?
I mean, you've argued that this kind of zone of ambiguity becomes kind of the liminal condition of politics today. No?
That's right, yeah. Today in the digital spectacle, you have this, so right? But truth and falsity have no distinction anymore. Yeah.
So one last, just an added question from me before I hand over the mic. Mm-hmm. Could you perhaps dwell a bit on how this foundational exclusion that results in a zone of ambiguity where this kind of partial humanization of, mm-hmm. of you know, dehumanization who's allowed in and the whole management of difference mm-hmm. according mm-hmm. to racialized scopic regime happens. So how do you see this vector of exteriority? And I'm not quite sure if I grasped mm-hmm. completely mm-hmm. this, the argument you made with the Boer and alienation mm-hmm. here in relation to exteriority. I'm interested in this because it seems to me that when modernized, mm-hmm. humanized subjects, mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. put it like that, look at something like we're going to see later, mm-hmm. look at images of people under
Spirit possession,
mm-hmm. trying to say, there is something happening in the visual regime that has everything to do with exteriority versus a form of self-possession and a contained, mm-hmm. or the fiction of self-containment and mm-hmm. self-possession. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder if you could, if that makes sense to you, and how you draw the mm-hmm. connection to this argument you made about.
I'm not sure that I can answer that directly. I'll answer it in an oblique way. In my view, I find it difficult to say anything about the Hauka ritual itself and the Hauka spirit possession, what's happening there, externality or internality, what is happening there. But I think we can talk about what it is for us watching Ruch's film. We're not watching the Hauka spirit possession. We are watching a work of art, and it's a film. And we as viewers can talk in relation to that kind of, you know, we are subjects of mimesis only in relation as film spectators. I think that's the only relation we have. So it's a slightly hyperbolic argument I'm making. I'm just saying that today, because I live in the US and it's just a bizarre situation in a way that you cannot believe what it's like to live, you know, under Trumpian rule. It's really a bizarre situation. My sense is that today what we have is sort of, you can't really distinguish between external and internal anymore. Ambiguity, the prohibited and the permitted. The ambiguity has taken over, right? So you can't distinguish anymore. So that's why James Fallows is saying, you know, if this video becomes part of the Trump campaign, I'll vote for him. Right. What does that mean? It's not sarcasm. It's actually a sort of a... This is the condition of our existence right now. Right. So that's what I mean. So it's a kind of I'm hyperbolizing this thing. Right. But I think the idea that we can sit here and sort of discuss how spirit possession is categorically... It's impossible. And I think we should recognize our limitations. We can talk about the film made by Rush. We can talk about ourselves as spectators of the film. And we can talk about Rush's technology and his techniques. But that's it. Does that make sense? I mean, you sort of see...
I'll do it by the order of...
Okay.
So, please, yes. Sorry. Just one sec. But now the mic is there because you can't do it without the mic. Sorry. Yeah. Nobody will... Sorry.
You're
we'll come back
serious.
To it.
Okay. Thank you so much for your talk. I am here like...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Uh-huh. And also for your book, Desire and Whiteness. That
thank
is
you.
Like very important for me. And also coming from this book and what you said in the end, like the white subject without leg and the leg with...
Lack of a leg.
Yeah. So I thought when there's no leg, Lacan, it's a Lacanian question,
yes.
More or less. There is anxiety, or
yes.
The lack of the leg produces anxiety.
Exactly. Yeah.
While I would say like whiteness as mimicry, there is the... danger like that mimicry might hide or mask a lack. So how do you think together like whiteness as mimicry and whiteness as subjects
okay.
without lack?
Thank you.
Also in regard to like anxiety that might be produced.
Right. Thank you so much for that question. So this helps me clarify something. That is, I don't think we can say that whiteness is mimicry exactly. I would... If I may be, I just didn't want to get too technical. And it can get very boring. I sort of see whiteness as instituting a particular, shall we say, structure in which subjectivity, being a subject, is sort of haunted by mimicry and masquerade and, you know, that sort of thing. But whiteness as such, I mean, I think of it as a sort of like the big other. Right, that organizes meaning and subjectivity. There's no other way in the West to sort of like understand people except by processing their appearance, right? I mean, that's the first thing people in the West see immediately is, you know, what race are you? That's, you know, and it's not just simply skin color of your eyes, the shape of your nose, but it's actually very subtle. And I think this gets played out very, in all its calibrated forms, especially in the US with the one drop rule, right? So that's what I mean by saying that whiteness organizes and produces a kind of a, you know, the possibility of the gaze and mimicry. You know, your subjectivity sort of in some way shaped by that. Is that making sense? Yeah. So, yeah. Is that, yeah? All right. Okay. Lacan's not the easiest, I mean.
for TED Talks.
But he is so useful in thinking about subjectivity in terms of a certain kind of a splitting, right? That we're not all just conscious beings, that the unconscious in many ways sort of like shapes us. I mean, we are who we are in relation to our unconscious.
It's all right, because Lacan, mm-hmm. Lacan actually saw the film in the 50s.
Yeah, so I heard.
Yeah, that's right. And he said that he's not, he doesn't have the competence to, exactly as you said, not the competence to say what the Hawker are doing. So it's not part of his psychiatric and psychoanalytic knowledge. So he acknowledged that.
Yeah.
And
we don't have the tools to psychoanalyze them or understand them. We can do ethnography, but we're doing ethnography for ourselves.
Well, we have possession cards too in Europe, so. So what understanding
sure.
is, we'll find out. But I was asking because I find it fascinating to look forward to the film and find out today what we find out about Trump by watching this film, because
mm-hmm.
I think it's a good experiment. And it will be maybe an interesting experiment to compare with other reactions to Les Maîtres Fous, because you maybe know that Jean Genet wrote a drama after watching Les Maîtres Fous that was Les Nègres.
Yes.
And of course, maybe that would be also the opportunity to do another theatrical performance of Les Nègres, but then as the, because it's always played, of course, between the whites and the blacks in mm-hmm. the in this theater. Mm-hmm. And also there was a performance in the 1960s of a play by German writer Weiss, Peter Weiss, using, Peter Brook used this material also for the Marat de Sade, which mm-hmm. is also basically a critical whiteness study.
Right, and also so isn't it true that Brecht used Les Maîtres Fous as a way
no.
to sort of train his actors?
No, that was basically what Peter Brook did.
Okay.
Peter Brook
right.
tried to at least okay. At least sit. He used that for this thing. So, but actually, you know, this moment of farce is basically where you started. Farce mm-hmm. is basically also what is Trump is all about, mm-hmm. and also maybe this affirmative film, this Japanese thing too, that you think of a person that's so narcissistic that he's God or he's the king, he's a child and all that, and you immediately understand what he is. And you find that in farce too, like Ubu Roi, of course, by Alfred Jarry, which is after all, about German European colonialism
yes.
too, in a sense.
Yes, of course.
So it's this farcical moment of being the king, of ruling the world, and mm-hmm. so on. It's deeply embedded in the modernist thing that goes into Les Maîtres Fous, don't you think? Mm-hmm. That is also a way of reading, mm-hmm. nevertheless, also from the...
That's right.
And Nips, maybe too.
Mm-hmm. That's right, exactly. I mean, I think that's a great comment. Thank you so much.